Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover the first 12 verses of Daniel chapter 7. And even though it's only 12 verses, it's going to be a long audio because this is a very difficult chapter. We start in Daniel 7:1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream with visions in his mind as he was lying in his bed. He wrote down the dream, and here is the summary of his account. Now, what's the date of this? Well, the four beast vision that we have in this chapter occurs between Daniel 4, which was about the tree stump of Nebuchadnezzar, and Daniel 5, which is about Belshazzar's feast. Daniel 7 is not in chronological order. In other words, the tree stump vision was given somewhere at the beginning of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. He reigned from 605 to 562, so that'll put it around the turn of the century, say 600, 590, somewhere around there. Belshazzar's feast, we know, was at 539 when the Persians beat the Babylonians. That's chapter 5. And now we back up to the first year of Belshazzar. Belshazzar was made regent for his father Nabonidus in 553. So that's where we are now in 553 B.C. Belshazzar was regent all the way until the Babylonian Empire fell in 539. So Daniel had a dream with visions. He gives a general outline of the world powers, which are going to be talked about here in chapter 7. The details of these world powers will be given later in chapters 8 through 12 to the end of the book. And this vision that Daniel had is the most comprehensive of Daniel's visions. It encompasses all of ancient history, basically. Now note that these visions belong to Daniel. The first two dreams or visions belong to Nebuchadnezzar, the four metal statue in chapter 2 and the chopped down tree in chapter 4. Daniel interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dreams, but now Daniel has a dream of his own. He gives a summary of his account in chapter 7. A summary, we don't get all the details. I guess the details are either following later on in the book. Maybe he's referring to a summary just here in chapter 7, or maybe the whole book is just a summary of all he saw. I'm not really sure. We go now to Daniel 7, verses 2 through 3. Daniel said, "In my vision at night, I was watching, and suddenly the four winds of heaven stirred up the great sea. Four huge beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other." So this is the four beast vision, we'll call it. Daniel refers to the four winds of heaven stirring up the sea. God often uses winds to strive against evil men. We see that in the scriptures, Psalm 35:5, "Let them be chaff in the wind, with the angel of the Lord driving them away." Psalm 48:7, "You wrecked the ships of Tarshish with the east wind." Psalm 107, verse 25, "He spoke and raised a tempest that stirred up the waves of the sea." Isaiah 41:16, "You will winnow them, and a wind will carry them away. A gale will scatter them." So here, God is rousing the world empires to do his will. Some say it's satanic forces that were making the sea start getting choppy, getting stirred up. The sea symbolizes the whole world and the activities of the nations therein. I guess it could go either way. At any rate, the sea containing these four huge beasts is getting stirred up. So the imagery is clear. The sea stands for the world powers of this world, as we often note as we study prophecy. Now, each of these beasts are said to be huge. These ancient empires were huge, and they were each different. We'll see how they were different as we go through. We go to Daniel 7, verse 4. "The first was like a lion, but had eagle's wings. I continued watching until its wings were torn off. It was lifted up from the ground, set on its feet like a man, and given a human mind." Now, this beast is the Babylonian Empire. It's referred to as a lion, which is the most majestic being on land. And it had eagle's wings. An eagle is the most majestic of the air creatures. Babylon was a majestic empire. Here's some scriptures where Babylon is compared both to a lion and an eagle. We start with a lion, Jeremiah 4:7. "A lion is gone up from his thicket. A destroyer of nations has set out. He has left his lair to make your land a waste." That's the land of Judea. "Your cities will be reduced to uninhabited ruins." That happened in 586 when the Babylonians wiped out Judah. Isaiah 5:29, "They are roaring as like a lion's." That's referring to Babylon. "They roar like young lions. They growl and seize their prey and carry it off." Now let's see how Babylon is referred to as an eagle. Ezekiel 17:3, "You are to say, this is what the Lord God says. A great eagle with great wings, long pinions, and full plumage of many colors came to Lebanon and took the top of the cedar." This is referring to Babylon, and by the way, this is not controversial at all. Everybody agrees with this. Ezekiel 17:7, "But there was another great eagle with great wings and thick plumage, and this vine bent its roots toward him." All right, so Babylon is the first world empire that is being referred to here. Its greatest king was Nebuchadnezzar, who ruled from 605 to 539. It had wings like an eagle. Those wings represent the speed with which Babylon conquered countries. Under Nebuchadnezzar, between 605 and 539, Babylon conquered Syria, Phoenicia, Judea, Egypt, Arabia. But in verse 4, its wings were torn off. Its majesty was humbled. The next empire, the Medo-Persian Empire, started plucking off some of Babylonian territory. Whole provinces revolted in the times of evil Merodach. He ruled after Nebuchadnezzar from 562 to 560, and provinces also revolted under Nergal-Sarnessar, who ruled from 560 to 556, and then finally under Belshazzar, who was the regent, Nabonidus' son. He was regent from 553 to 539. So Lydia, which is in western Anatolia, Media, north of Iran and Persia, on the Iranian plateau, to the east of the Tigris River, all of those were provinces of the Babylonian Empire, and then they became independent. And finally, the Persians gobbled them up. So, Babylonia had its wings torn off. Now, this eagle was lifted up from the ground, which means its wings were torn off, so it couldn't fly, so it crashed on the ground, and then it was set on its feet like a man. Couldn't fly anymore, could only walk, so that represents the weakness of the Babylonian Empire under its latter kings. This man was given a human mind. Now, that's kind of confusing. I like a better translation, a human heart. Many translations do so translate it. The NASB note translates it as mind, but it has a note that says literally heart. It literally means heart. So this man was given a human heart. A human heart is much more timid than a lion's heart, and that's the idea. It could only walk, and it was frightened because it was humbled, even as Nebuchadnezzar was humbled when he became an ox that wandered around in the grass for 7 years. We go now to Daniel 7:5. Suddenly another beast appeared, a second one that looked like a bear. It was raised up on one side with three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, "Get up, gorge yourself on flesh." Now this bear refers to the Medo-Persian Empire. Now some conservatives and most all liberals say it's the Median Empire, and I'm going to refer to that here because I don't think it's true. Why is it not true? Well, Media didn't follow Babylon. In these successive empires in Daniel's vision, we see one empire following the next, but the Median Empire didn't follow Babylonia. It was rather contemporary with Babylon. And in fact, Guzik says, Media even rose to strength before the Neo-Babylonian period, before Nabopolassar, Nebuchadnezzar's father, which, if I remember correctly, is about when the Neo-Babylonian Empire started. Well, Media was already around, so Media did not really follow Babylon. Plus, the Medes by themselves never had a world position comparable to Babylonians, Persians, and Greeks. They were a little tiny kingdom. So no, the bear is not Media. It's the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, a bear is slower and stronger and more crushing than a lion, so that shows a difference between the Babylonian Lion Empire. Here's what Guzik says, the slow crushing armies of the Medo-Persian Empire were well known. They simply overwhelmed their opponents with superior size and strength. Adam Clark says the largest species of these animals was found in Media, bears, a mountainous, cold, and rough country covered with woods. Now, a bear doesn't have the majestic bearing of the lion or eagle. Medes and Persians are a fierce and cruel people. As John Gill says, they are less polished and more uncivilized than the Chaldeans. Well, I don't know if you can say a bear is less civilized than a lion. That might be pushing the metaphor a little much. Now, this bear was tilted over to one side. It was raised up on one side. Here are a couple of options as to what that means. It could mean that the bear was raised up on one side of the lion. In other words, as Persia was on the eastern side of Babylon, to the east of the Tigris River, looking over at Babylon, which was going from west to east, from the Tigris to the Euphrates, Persia was raised up over Babylon to destroy it. I think I've read other people who say that the raised up posture of this bear refers to the Persian side of the Medo-Persian alliance dominating that alliance. I think that's what it refers to. That's my personal preference. I can't prove it because Persia, of course, was stronger than Media. This, by the way, is well-known ancient history. There's nothing controversial here. We're not going to hit controversy until we get to the little horn. Well, maybe I should take that back. There are three ribs in the bear's mouth. Now, people do disagree on that. Let me give you some options before I give you the option I think is correct. Option number one, these three ribs are three empires absorbed by Cyrus the Persian, Cyrus the Great. the Babylonians, the Medes, and the Persians. Problem with that, the bear, standing for Persia, would be eating itself. So that seems kind of problematical. Some other people have translated ribs as teeth, and so three rows of teeth represent the triple power of the Babylonians, Medes, and Persians. That would support our first option, that the three ribs are Babylonians, Medes, and Persians. Option number two, the three ribs represent the three directions of the compass, east, north, and south, that were subdued by the Persians. I think that's weak. Option number three, the three ribs represent the west, north, and south subdued by the Persians. Again, I think that's weak. Option number four, the three ribs represent the three kings that followed Darius the Mede. Of course, Darius the Mede himself is controversial. Those three kings would be Cyrus the Great, Ahasuerus, i.e. Xerxes, and then Darius the First the Great. Why would the first three kings of Persia be in the Persian bear's mouth? I don't know. Here's your best option, in my humble opinion. Option number five, the three ribs represent three prominent empires conquered by Persia. Lydia was conquered in 550. Lydia is in western Anatolia, western present-day Turkey, whose king, one of its kings, was the famous Croesus, as in he's rich as Croesus. Babylon was conquered in 539 by the Persians, as is well known. Recall Belshazzar's feast. And then Egypt, under the Persian emperor Cambyses, who conquered Egypt famously in 525. Those three ribs were eaten up by Persia. Now, I like that option better because Persia's not eating itself. Guzik said this is the majority opinion. Isaac Newton held that opinion, and somebody as smart as Isaac Newton, he wouldn't be wrong. And how about this? ChatGPT even says that. Artificial intelligence. So we're going to assume that Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt are the three ribs. Now, the bear was told, get up, gorge yourself on flesh. This is a reference to the extreme cruelties of the Persians. And, of course, who was devoured? Well, option number one, many nations, but especially the Babylonians, might be referred to here, or it could be referring to those three kingdoms I just mentioned, Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. Doesn't really matter. The point is, Persia's going to be eating some meat. Now we go to verse 6 of Daniel 7. While I was watching, another beast appeared. It was like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back. It had four heads and was given authority to rule. Now this leopard, again, not much dispute on this, refers to Alexander the Great's Grecian kingdom. He was from Macedon, right north of Greece. His culture was Greek. And of course, he famously conquered Persia. Died in 323. I think he started out conquering in 336. I think I forgot the exact date. He had a famous run. This has to be prophecy on Daniel's part. Daniel might have humanly guessed that the Medes and Persians were coming shortly after the Babylonians, whom he was serving, but he could not have guessed Alexander the Great, because that was quite a remarkable feat that Alexander pulled off. Alexander was known for sudden, unexpected attacks, like a leopard. A leopard is very fast, very courageous. As Clark says, Alexander the Great ran through all the countries from Illyricum, that's in the area north of the Adriatic Sea, from Illyricum and the Adriatic Sea to the Indian Ocean and the River Ganges, and in 12 years subdued part of Europe and all Asia, as well as Egypt, Syria, and Palestine. You have to read the biographies of Alexander the Great to get a feel for this. It was incredible what he did. Now, a leopard is smaller than a lion. This might indicate that Alexander started from much more humble beginnings than Babylonia did, because Alexander was the head of a little tiny kingdom called Macedonia and ended up conquering the whole world very quickly, like a leopard. Now, this leopard had four wings and four heads. So that shows that this leopard was especially swift, with four wings showing that the leopard could fly. He was especially clever because he had four heads. Four heads could think better than one head. Alexander the Great used 30,000 soldiers to subdue 600,000 soldiers, one of my commentators said. It's amazing. Now let's look at a couple of options as to what the four wings might refer to. Option number one, Persian power. Macedonian power extends to the four corners of the earth. The pulpit commentary denies that. Kyle and Delitzsch affirm it. Option number two, the four wings refer to rapidity of movement, how fast Alexander moved. The pulpit commentary affirms this, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I could not find any commentator saying that the four wings referred to Alexander's four successor kingdoms, but I wonder why not. Now let's turn to the four heads. These refer to the Diadochi, the successor generals to Alexander the Great. If you recall from your knowledge of ancient history, Alexander died after his conquest in Babylon from a fever. He did not leave a plan of succession, and so his generals fought over the remains of his empire. The problem is that there were a lot of generals, and people disagree on who the four major generals were who took over. Let me give you a couple of options. Cassander, who reigned over Macedonia and Greece. Lysimachus, who ruled over Thrace and Bithynia. Thrace is right north of Greece, and Bithynia is across the Aegean Sea at the northern end of Anatolia. That would be Lysimachus. And then Ptolemy, of course, ruled over Egypt, and Seleucus, of course, ruled over Syria and Persia. Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus is option number one. Option number two would be the four most notable Diadochi. This is from Wikipedia. Cassander ruled over Macedon and Greece. Antigonus ruled over Asia Minor, across the Aegean Sea, present-day Turkey. Ptolemy ruled over Egypt, and Seleucus ruled over Syria, with its headquarters at Antioch, and Persia. And I think that's the most reasonable suggestion as to which of these four Diadochi successors of Alexander ruled and who are represented by the four heads of the leopard. Now the leopard, in verse 6, is said to have been given authority to rule. That authority that Alexander the Great had, it had to be given to him by God. There's no other way to explain his incredible success. We go now to Daniel 7, verse 7. While I was watching in the night visions, a fourth beast appeared, frightening and dreadful, and incredibly strong with large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed, and it trampled with its feet whatever was left. It was different from all the beasts before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, folks, this is so obvious of the Roman Empire, I cannot believe that some people think that the fourth beast is the Grecian Empire of Alexander the Great. To me, it's ludicrous, but there are some smart people who believe that. So, I'm just an amateur. I won't say anything about the emperor not having any clothes on. Now, the fourth beast, frightening and dreadful, was the largest, strongest, and most unified, enduring empire of them all, the Roman Empire was. The Roman Empire lasted a lot longer, for example, than Alexander's empire, which lasted, what, about 13 years? Roman Empire lasted from, I don't know, from the times of, let's say, Julius Caesar, 40-something B.C. The Eastern Roman Empire finally died in 1453. That's a long time. That's a millennium and a half. This beast that Daniel saw, he just called it dreadful. It was not compared to any known animal. It was a monster. And of course, the Roman Empire appeared that way to Christians who had been persecuted by the empire, especially during the times of Nero. This beast had 10 horns, and of course, a horn represents the power of an animal. If an animal has 10 horns, it's very powerful. This is an unmistakable reference to the 10 toes in the four metal man vision, which we read about in Daniel 2:33. Its legs were iron, and its feet were partly iron and partly fired clay. Now, those 10 toes in the four metal man vision probably represented the provinces of Rome, because they were not really tied into the central government there. It had different ethnicities and so forth. And so the feet being iron and feet being clay shows that the empire was weak in the provinces. But if we want to take the 10 horns here in verse 7 to represent the 10 provinces, we can. But the problem is that the 10 horns are explicitly said to be the first 10 emperors of the Roman Empire. We read in Daniel 7, verse 24, which we'll get to in our next audio, "As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings will arise." Not 10 provinces, but 10 kings. "And another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones, and will subdue 3 kings. We'll get to what all that means in just a minute, but the point is that I think the 10 horns on this monstrous beast, this iron beast, if you will, represent the 10 emperors, not the 10 provinces. By the way, the 10 provinces, according to F.W. Farrar, a theologian writing in the 19th century, he said they were Italy, Achaia, that's Greece, Asia, Asia Minor, Syria, Egypt, Africa, Spain, Gaul, Britain, and Germany. However, if you look at Wikipedia and look at the map, you'll see that there's all kinds of provinces, because as time changed, the provinces changed, the borders were changed, so that's a little bit problematical. But the first 10 emperors, we know who they are, basically, and so that's what we're going to go with, the 10 horns of the 10 emperors of the Roman Empire. Now, in verse 7, we see this monstrous beast has large iron teeth. You notice our metals are going from gold, soft but valuable. Next is silver. I'm using the image of the four metal man statue in chapter 2. Gold, silver, bronze, and iron. The metals are getting stronger, but they're worthless. At any rate, we're down to the fourth beast, who had iron teeth, just like the fourth section of the four metal man statue. One of my commentators says that this mention of iron is an unmistakable reference to the iron legs and toes in the four metal man. I think so. Now, the monster devoured and crushed. This is Daniel seeing this in his vision. The fourth monster, the fourth beast, trampled with its feet whatever was left. In other words, the other three kingdoms, the remains of the other three kingdoms. And that's what happened, because those other three kingdoms are gone. But the Roman Empire took over the territory of the Babylonians, the Persians, and the Macedonian Greeks. Now, this monstrous beast was different from all the beasts before it, and it had 10 horns. As verse 10 says, the monstrous beast, the Roman Empire, was different in extent of dominion. It was bigger than all the other empires, and also it was different in duration. It lasted longer than the other empires. It was the granddaddy. It was the mother of all empires. We go now to Daniel 7, verse 8. While I was considering the horns, suddenly another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. There were eyes in this horn like a man's, and it had a mouth that spoke arrogantly. All right, now here is one of the most complicated issues in eschatology and in Bible prophecy. I'm going to give it my best shot, remembering that I am a mere amateur in a world of professionals when it comes to eschatology. First of all, let's get rid of some easy references. First of all, this little one had the eyes of a man. What does that mean? It means he's intelligent. He uprooted three of the other horns, three of the other emperors. That shows that those three horns, those three emperors, were inferior in strength to whoever this little horn is. And now we get to the big issue. Who is this little horn? Well, as usual, these type of issues divide between the preterist, the historicist, and the futurist. Preterists like to fulfill prophetic events somewhere around the time of Jesus and the early Roman Empire. The historicists like to do it in the Middle Ages, around the time of the Reformation. And the futurists like to put it off sometime way in the future. Well, the historicists say the little horn is the Pope. That's because the historicists blame everything on the Pope, because that's what they were fighting back then. In my opinion, historicists are newspaper eschatologists. They took the events of their day and shoehorned those events into biblical prophetic text. I don't believe in doing that, so we're not going to discuss that. Now, the futurists say this little one, this little horn, is the future Antichrist, naturally, because futurists love to talk about the Antichrist. I'm going to call him the capital A Antichrist. Some futurists say, no, it's Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, but he is a type of the Antichrist. Well, let me say something about that first option, a future Antichrist. A futurist cannot predict the future any more than I can, so how can I argue with him? This is what futurists say. This is what's going to happen. The Antichrist is going to do this. How am I going to dispute that? I can't read the future. But let me tell you something else. A futurist can't predict the future any better than I can. So it's all speculation when you start talking about the future. I'm talking about the future from now. It's all speculation. So what's the point of arguing about it? I just refuse to do it. The other day, a futurist in my church said that he was looking into the issue of whether Trump was the Antichrist. And this is a guy who voted for Trump. I said, is Trump the Antichrist? Really? I'm not going to spend 10 seconds of my time worrying about whether Trump is the Antichrist. In my short life, I have heard it said that Henry Kissinger was the Antichrist, Muammar Gaddafi was the Antichrist, Ronald Reagan was the Antichrist, Mikhail Gorbachev was the Antichrist. Personally, I think Tim LaHaye or Hal Lindsey, probably, I think they're the Antichrist. Why not? Why not? Let's just speculate. So we're not going to do that, but let's look at the idea that the little horn might be Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Now, he's an historical character. He ruled the Seleucid Empire between 175 BC and 164 BC. Now, if this Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes is the little horn who uprooted three other horns, we need to identify who the other three horns might be. Now, I'm going to give you some options that advocates of this view come up with. I am going to give you five options. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them explaining who they are. I just want to show you how much confusion there is. There's Seleucus IV, ruled from 187 to 175, the Seleucid Empire. He's the older brother of Antiochus IV. The problem with choosing him for a horn, he was murdered by Heliodorus, his treasurer, and there is no evidence to connect Antiochus IV to the crime. Well, how about Demetrius, the son of Antiochus IV? Demetrius never reigned until after Antiochus IV's death. He was being held hostage in Rome. Well, how about Antiochus, another son of Antiochus IV? Antiochus, the son of Antiochus IV, never ruled. He was a mere boy during the time of Antiochus IV. Well, how about Heliodorus? He was Seleucus IV's treasurer, who murdered Seleucus IV. Heliodorus claimed Syria, but he never had actual control of Syria, so it's hard to see how he could be an uprooted horn. He doesn't sound like a horn that was rooted up. And then there's Ptolemy VI, Philometor. Ptolemy VI, Philometor. He was the king of Egypt while Antiochus IV ruled in Syria. Ptolemy VI claimed, but he never had actual control of the Syrian crown. So he didn't have control, so he couldn't be uprooted. Well, those who advocate that Antiochus IV is the little horn, they point out that Antiochus IV had a mouth uttering great boast, such as the little horn had in chapter 7, verse 20. And in verse 21 of this chapter, chapter 7, the little horn waged war with the saints and overpowered them. Well, that sounds like Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who, of course, opposed the Jewish saints during the Maccabean War. Well, in my humble opinion, that's a weak case. Let's go over some weaknesses of the Antiochus Epiphanes view. First of all, as I pointed out, it's very difficult to pinpoint the three uprooted kings. Also, in verse 20 of this chapter, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, the little horn, is said to be larger in appearance than his associates. Well, how is Antiochus IV larger in appearance than his associates? He was not particularly imposing relative to his predecessors. In fact, his father, Antiochus III, was called the Great. Antiochus III was a far more imposing figure than Antiochus IV was. Now, the advocates of Antiochus Epiphanes IV say that he was larger in appearance to the Jews because he was the one that came down and instigated the Maccabean revolt by his putting the pig on the altar and so forth. But the worst weakness, in my opinion, of this view that the little horn is Antiochus Epiphanes is the fact that he arose out of the Greek kingdom. He was Greek. He was a successor, Didache, one of the Didache, successor of Alexander the Great. That's a Greek kingdom. But this little horn comes out of the ten horns of the Roman kingdom, the fourth beast. Now, of course, there are some who say that the fourth kingdom is Greece. I've already dismissed that. That's a minority view. It's also very weak. So we're going to ditch Antiochus IV Epiphanes, and we're going to look at two other options. These are preterist options, typically held by Orthodox preterists. There seems to me to be an even split between two possible Roman emperors who could be the little horn. The first option is the Emperor Vespasian. Now, Vespasian ruled the Roman Empire from AD 69 to AD 79. Here are reasons put forward by the preterists who believe he's the little horn. First of all, Vespasian's intelligence. The little horn had the eyes of a man. That sounds like an intelligent person. Here's what the Roman historian Suetonius said about Vespasian. He was, quote, a survivor, a shrewd politician. He behaved most generously to all classes, giving out plenty of money, and a patron of the arts. He lived an orderly and structured life, was nearly always just as good-natured, cracking frequent jokes, had a knack of apt quotation from the Greek classics. Also, Vespasian was said to be boastful. In verse 8 of chapter 7 of Daniel, the little horn spoke arrogantly. This is supposed to apply to Vespasian. Here's what Josephus says about Vespasian in his book, The Jewish War. Quote, Vespasian's good fortune succeeded to his wishes everywhere, and the public affairs were for the greatest part already in his hands, upon which he considered that he had not arrived at the government without divine providence, but that a righteous kind of fate had brought the empire under his power. In other words, Vespasian is arrogant in that he only gave fate credit for his accession to the throne, but he did not give God the credit. That, to me, is a little bit weak. But now here's some stronger evidence that Vespasian is the little horn. He uprooted three horns. Well, Vespasian took charge of the Roman Empire in 69, and between halfway through 68 and all the way through 69, there was civil war in Rome. 69 was called the year of four emperors, or 68 through 69. It's called the year of four emperors. The three previous emperors to Vespasian were three military men, Galba, Otho, and Vitellus. They fought in the civil wars, and one after the other, they were beaten by their successor. And finally, Vespasian left the siege of Jerusalem in AD 69 and said, I've had enough of this. He wiped out the last of the three emperors, Vitellus. And so there the argument goes, he uprooted the three horns that came before him. But now people will point out a problem to that. They say that uprooting means a violent overthrow. Here's what Glenn Miller, the Christian think tank guy, who is quoted by J.P. Holding, another apologist, Miller says that uprooting, quote, denotes a violent overthrow and does not imply that an individual will merely succeed a previous king or kings to the throne, or merely displace the previous kings. Well, the answer to that is that Galba, Otho, and Vitellus were violently overthrown. But then we have a further problem. Vespasian didn't do the overthrowing, not of the first two, Galba and Otho. Well, the answer to that is he ended up on top after the Civil War, so he won. He uprooted the three previous emperors. I don't have any problem with taking uproot in a less than hyper-literal manner. He uprooted them. He got rid of them because he ended up on top. To me, that's a minor objection, but people like to make it. Now, in verse 20 of chapter 7, the little horn is said to be larger in appearance than all the others. Well, to the Jews, Vespasian was larger in appearance than all the other emperors because he was the one who destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70. He attacked Jerusalem and his son Titus finished the job. Vespasian started out little and he ended up larger, just like the little horn did. Now, this fits Vespasian quite well. Vespasian's origins were completely obscure. At one point, he was engaged in the mule trade, as Wikipedia points out, and his nickname was Mulio, which means muleteer. So he was a little horn, all right? He was a nobody. Then all of a sudden, he ended up being the emperor that attacked Jerusalem and who was in charge when Jerusalem was burnt to the ground. He left it in charge to his son, Titus. Now, another argument in favor of Vespasian is that there were 10 horns on this fourth beast that Daniel's having a dream about. Well, Vespasian was the 10th emperor. Let me list the emperors for you. Number 1, Julius Caesar. Number 2, Octavius Augustus Caesar. Number 3, Tiberius. Number 4, Caligula. Number 5, Claudius. Number 6, Nero. Number 7, Galba. Number 8, Otto. Number 9, Vitellius. Those are the GOV, the three emperors who were uprooted. And then there's Vespasian, number 10. He uprooted the three previous ones, and then he became king. So since he's the 10th emperor, that seems to fit Vespasian pretty good. Argument number 6, that Vespasian is the little horn. Vespasian wore out the saints, that is the Jewish saints, for 3.5 years in the Jewish War. The Jewish War started in the middle of 66, ended in 70, that's 3.5 years. Vespasian was in charge of the Roman troops when the war began. We read in Daniel 7:25, the little horn will speak words against the Most High and oppress the holy ones of the Most High. That's the saints of the Most High. He will intend to change religious festivals and laws, and the holy ones will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. 3.5 years, that's what Vespasian did. He tried to change the religious festivals and laws of the saints, of the Jewish saints, when he started the Jewish War. Now, an objection to that is that if you take the saints, the holy ones, in verse 25, the saints who are oppressed for 3.5 years, time, times, and half a time, if you take those to be the Jewish saints subjected to Vespasian's attack in the Jewish War, then by context, you would take the saints in Daniel 7:27 to be the Jewish saints. We read in Daniel 7:27, the kingdom, dominion, and greatness of the kingdoms under all of heaven will be given to the people, the holy ones, the saints of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will serve and obey him. Now, those saints are obviously Christians who are inheriting the spiritual kingdom. And so the argument goes, well, in verse 25, it's Vespasian worrying out the Jewish saints. How was it that the Jewish saints inherited the kingdom? An answer to that objection would be, first of all, the Jews in verse 25 included Christian Jews. They were attacked by Vespasian, and they inherited the kingdom in verse 27. I think this is an example of where Old Testament believers morph into New Testament believers. I don't think you have to point out that it was Jewish Christians who were attacked in verse 25 and then inherited the kingdom in verse 27. I just think we're talking about saints in verse 25. They're Jewish saints. Well, they're types of the old Israel who become the new Israel, the antitypes. I don't have a bit of a problem with that. This is an example of where Old Testament believers morph into New Testament believers. Well, now let's look at weaknesses, objections to the Vespasian as little horn view. Objection number one, it is said that 10 horns in Revelation, the 10 horns on the sea beast, which is the Roman Empire, refer to 10 provinces, not 10 emperors. And that ruins what would be a nice parallel. We read in Revelation 17:12, the 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they will receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. So those 10 kings are obviously the 10 provinces of Rome. And here we're talking about horns. And so there's no parallel with the book of Revelation. Well, the short answer to that is, if you want Vespasian to be the little horn, you do not require a parallel with the book of Revelation. It would be nice if it were there, but you don't require it. So that's not dispositive. Objection number two to the Vespasian view. Vespasian, though he humbled Vitellius, can in no sense be said to have humbled Galba and Otho, the first two of the three horns. Indeed, Vespasian, throughout his life, identified himself with the cause of Galba, the first of the three uprooted emperors. Tacitus says the first measure of Vespasian's reign was the vindication of the memory of Galba. Well, I don't think that completely destroys the Vespasian view. Just because he, for political reasons, exalted Galba, he didn't need to humble Galba. He just needed to take the kingdom from them. Uprooted, I take to mean he got the kingdom from those three. Well, let's look at weakness number three of the Vespasian view. In this chapter, chapter 7, verse 21, we see that Vespasian waged war with the saints and overpowered them. The weakness is Vespasian didn't wage war with the saints and overpower them, it is said. Christians had complete immunity from persecution under Vespasian. Christians even made converts in the imperial family itself. Well, how do we answer that objection? Well, first of all, his toleration of Christians came after the Jewish War, but before the Jewish War, and before Vespasian became emperor, he did wage war with the saints in the Jewish War. And I might point out that was both saved and unsaved Jewish saints. Or you could just simply say, yes, he did wage war with the saints. It was the Jewish saints. Whether they were Christian or not doesn't matter. He waged war with the Jewish saints, and that answers the objection. He did wage war with the saints and overpower them, just as Daniel 7, verse 21 says. Objection number four to the Vespasian view. Vespasian was the 10th emperor, but the little horn arose out of the 10 horns, and so that makes it sound like Vespasian was the 11th emperor. Verse 8, the verse that we're talking about now in Daniel 7, says, another horn, a little one, came up among them. Another horn. So it sounds like Vespasian is actually the 11th emperor. Well, how do we overcome this if we are advocating for Vespasian? We could make Pompey a king before the first emperor Julius Caesar. Pompey was the Roman general who conquered Israel in 63 BC, and so Vespasian would be the 11th emperor on that reckoning. I don't like that. It's true that from Israel's point of view, Pompey was their first ruler, and king is loosely translated a lot of times. The word can mean a ruler. I mean, that's possible, but I don't see why we have to go to such extremes to defend this view. Why can't we just say that Vespasian is the 10th horn, and then out of the 10th horn, in the vision, there rose a little horn, and he came up among the other nine? In other words, the dream morphs. It's a dream. It's a vision. Now, again, Vespasian can be called little because he was a muleteer, ended up being an emperor. And I just say that the 10th horn morphs into a little horn, and he's still the 10th emperor, and we don't have to worry about people saying he was the 11th emperor. All right, well, there's your argument in a nutshell for Vespasian. Now let's look at the other preterist view that says that the little horn is Nero. On the Nero view, the three emperors who lived after Nero was born, those emperors were assassinated to make way for Nero, who was not in the line of succession. Those three emperors were Tiberius, Caligula, and Claudius. So they were uprooted, they were plucked out, they were assassinated. Of course, you got the same problem as you got with Vespasius. Nero didn't assassinate all three of those emperors. Nero seems to fit well with the description of the little horn. In verse 20 of chapter 7, the little horn had eyes of a man, cunning intelligence. The little horn had a mouth uttering great boast. Nero claimed to be God. He had a huge idol of himself built in Rome's very famous golden image. In verse 20, he is said to be, the little horn is said to be larger in appearance than his associates. Well, to the Jews, he really was larger in appearance. He declared the Jewish war, got it started, so he did more damage to the Jews than the other emperors. He did more damage to the Christians than the other emperors because of the Neronian persecutions, which were very famous. Took Christians and wrapped them in animal skins and torched them to light up his garden parties, from whence we get the term Roman candles. So that fits pretty good. In fact, that fits better, in my opinion, than it does Vespasian. And then in verse 21, the little horn is said to wage war with the saints and to overcome them. Nero was famous for torturing Christians, as I just said. So he seems to fit the description of the little horn pretty good, and in fact better than Vespasian's. Now, what are some of the advantages of the view that Nero is the little horn? First of all, he comes out of the Roman beast, not the Greek one, so that makes him more likely than Antiochus Epiphanes IV. Another advantage of this view is that it fits well with the fact that Nero is mentioned in Revelation as coming from Rome. He's the sixth head of the beast. We read in Revelation 17:10, there are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is. Five have fallen. Those are the six emperors before Nero. One is. That's Nero. The other has not yet come. But when he comes, he must remain for a little while. That's Galba, who only lasted about 7 months in the year of four emperors, the first of the three horns that were uprooted. Also, Nero fits well with the book of Revelation because he is the referent of the number 666, Revelation 13:18. Here is wisdom. The one who has understanding must calculate the number of the beast because it is the number of a man. His number is 666. Now, of course, futurists love 666, but most Orthodox preterists take 666 to refer to Nero. It's relatively easy to prove, actually. If you'll listen to my podcast on Revelation 13, you can see the arguments for that. The third advantage of the Nero view is that Nero did wear out the saints for 3.5 years. Remember in verse 25, the little horn will speak words against the Most High and oppress the holy ones of the Most High. He will do this for a time, times, and half a time. Well, actually, Nero started persecuting the Christians in July of 64 after the great fire in Rome. Nero died in 68. If you look at the time period there, it's 3.5 years, time, times, and half a time. So you see, there's strong arguments for Nero to be the little horn instead of Vespasian. What are some disadvantages of the Nero argument? Again, same argument leveled against Nero as was leveled against Vespasian. It sounds like the little horn was the 11th emperor, whereas Nero was the 6th. It says another horn, a little one, came up among them. Well, again, I would answer that the same way as I did before under Vespasian. The sixth horn could morph into a little horn. It's a vision. The sixth horn is there. All of a sudden it starts changing, changing, changing. It comes into a little horn, and then it rises up above, and then it plucks out of the three horns. I don't think that argument holds too much weight, but now here's a much stronger argument against Nero. And in fact, this is the argument that the defendants of Nero as the little horn have really got to deal with. That's Daniel 7:24. We read this. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will rise from this kingdom. Another, different from the previous ones, will rise after them and subdue 3 kings. After. Well, Nero was number 6. Vespasian was number 10, so Vespasian fits after better than Nero does. Well, how do the Nero advocates deal with this? Well, I've got two possible solutions. First is from the Orthodox preterist scholar J. Rogers. He says that after is better translated as in the midst of them. So Daniel 7:24 will read this way. Another horn will rise as in the midst of them. Well, of course, that would solve the problem, but the problem is, it's real hard to find that in the translations and the lexicons. Well, he goes into Aramaic, he goes into stuff that's way over my head because I don't know Aramaic and Hebrew. You can check out his arguments at www.forerunner.com/Daniel. Another possible way to handle this problem that the little horn is said to come after the other horns is that the little horn arises after the beginning of the ten kings. He arises after the totality of the ten king set has begun. Let me read you from James Jordan, the famous Orthodox Preterist scholar. He's got a book on Daniel, a commentary on Daniel called The Handwriting on the Wall. He says this, what verse 24 means, however, is that the little horn arises after the sequence of ten horns begins, after it comes into being. While the horns represent the Roman emperors, Daniel does not see them coming up one after another. They come up as a totality, and the little horn appears after this totality has come into being, not after the tenth. So in other words, we can picture Daniel dreaming or having a vision, and all of a sudden he sees the beast, and boom, the ten horns popped up on the top of the beast. And then after that, after those ten horns pop up, the little horn pops up. That's a pretty good argument, in my opinion. The third weakness of the Nero view is, why should ten horns even be mentioned? Nero's the sixth king, why not stop with him? Well, if I were having to defend the Nero position, I would say, it makes sense that the ten horns end at Vespasian. He was the last ruler before Israel disappeared. He was the emperor when Israel went down. He became emperor in 69. Israel was destroyed in AD 70. And the ten horns would thus match the ten toes of the four metal statue in Daniel chapter 2. So you see, they're pretty good arguments for Nero. Pretty good arguments for Vespasian. I'm 50-50 on it. I don't know who it was. I report, you decide. We go now to Daniel 7, verses 9 through 10. Daniel continues, as I kept watching, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white like snow, and the hair of his head like whitest wool. His throne was flaming fire, its wheels were blazing fire. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from his presence. Thousands upon thousands served him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was convened, and the books were opened. Now, first of all, who is this Ancient of Days? Some of the theologians debate, was it God the Father or God the Son? No, I believe it was God the Father. Daniel 7:13 seems to make a distinction between the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man, because the Son of Man was coming up to the Ancient of Days. Why would the Son of Man be coming up to himself? We read a few verses later in verse 13 of Daniel 7, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days. So you see, you've got the Son of Man in the vision, and you've got the Ancient of Days in the vision. Now, let's look at what the phrase Ancient of Days, the term, means. BibleStudyTools.com says the words Ancient of Days are a way of describing that God is a first-hand spectator to the past, present, and future. In other words, he's been around long time before days even got started. GotQuestions.org says that the phrase Ancient of Days means exactly that, that God existed before time began. Now the Ancient of Days, who I suppose looked like a man, said his clothing was white. White stands for the purity of his nature, the brightness of his majesty, the incorruptibility of his judgment. His throne was flaming fire, its wheels were blazing fire. Many commentators say that in the ancient Eastern world, royal thrones were often on wheels, and the wheels could symbolize the endless activity of God. Think about God's throne in Ezekiel, the first few chapters of Ezekiel. The wheels that were perpendicular to each other so the throne could go north, south, east, and west, depending on which wheels were turning. So when you see the throne of God in the Old Testament scripture, the throne always has wheels, which shows endless activity and movement of God. Its wheels were blazing fire. Fire stands for judgment, because if you get burnt, you're judged. It also stands for purity, because fire heats up metal so that the dross will bubble out. In verse 10, a river of fire was flowing. Not only were the wheels on fire, but a river of fire was flowing out from in front of the Ancient of Days. And then in front of the Ancient of Days, we see thousands upon thousands serving God. That would be perhaps host of angels. And then 10,000 times 10,000 standing before him. That could refer to all humanity standing before God. That's speculation, but it sounds good to me. Notice these numbers are not meant to be taken literally, so we can guard against hyperliteralism. It just means lots and lots of entities. The idea that thousands upon thousands refers to angels makes sense because there are less angels, I would think, than humanity, 10,000 times 10,000, although I've never counted how many angels there are, on top of a pen or in heaven or anywhere else. Now, God appears here on his throne as a judge. The court was convened and the books were opened. Well, why was the judge holding court? Why were the books opened? Adam Clark and John Gill say that this was judgment on the fourth beast, the Roman Empire, not the final judgment. I guess that might be a good theological paper. Is this the final judgment or is it the judgment on the Roman Empire? I will leave that for your further study. We go now to Daniel 7, verses 11 through 12. Daniel continues, I watched. Then because of the sound of the arrogant words, the horn was speaking. In other words, Daniel was fascinated by this little horn blabbing away in his dream or in his vision. As I continued watching, the beast was killed. That's talking about the monstrous beast, the fourth beast, the beast with 10 horns. The beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beast, their authority to rule was removed, but an extension of life was granted to them for a certain period of time. Well, in verse 11, the beast, the fourth beast, the Roman Empire is destroyed. That's easy enough. The Roman Empire was destroyed. Now, some people object that it didn't happen overnight. I don't know where it says that in a vision, if something is destroyed, it has to happen in one day, like the Babylonians were destroyed by the Persians. It took a while in history for the Roman Empire to be destroyed, but eventually Christianity wiped out paganism in the Christian Roman Empire. Now, this vision of Daniel, I would suppose, is parallel to the vision that John the Revelator, the apostle, had in Revelation 20, verse 10. The devil who deceived them was thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur, where the beast, that's the sea beast, the Roman Empire, and the false prophet are, false prophet being apostate Israel, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. So Daniel gets to see the end of the persecuting Roman Empire that wore out the saints for time, times, and half a time. Now, verse 12, as for the rest of the beast, their authority to rule was removed. That would be the lion, Babylon, the bear, Medo-Persia, the leopard, Alexander the Great, and his successor kingdoms. Their authority to rule was removed, but an extension of life was granted to them, granted to those three beasts. Now, what does that mean? Two options. Option number one, the pagan world powers continued after each of the first three kingdoms were destroyed. In other words, there was no establishment of the worship of the true God after the Babylonians went down, or after the Persians went down, or after Alexander the Great and his successors went down. You still got paganism. But after the fourth beast went down, after the Roman Empire went down, you had belief in Jesus, the true God. And so, concerning Babylon, Persia, and the great kingdom of Alexander the Great, their authority to rule was removed politically. True, but they had an extension of life because their same energizing pagan principles were still around after their political authority went down. That's option number one. Now here's option number two. This is from the pulpit commentary. The pagan empires continued as political subdivisions after the empires fell. For example, when Babylon was conquered by the Persian Empire, Babylon remained a province in the Persian Empire. Babylon remained a province in the Persian Empire. And then when Alexander the Great and his Macedonian Greek Empire was established, it was established at the expense of Persia, and Persia remained a province in Alexander's Macedonian Empire. And then when Alexander's successor generals were conquered by the Romans, Syria, under the Seleucids, formerly, after the Seleucids were beaten, Syria became a province of the Roman Empire. Likewise, Cassander, who controlled Greece, when he went down, or when his kingdom, not him personally, but his kingdom of Greece went down, Greece became a province of the Roman Empire. And when Egypt went down, you know, with Cleopatra, all that famous story of Mark Antony, Julius Caesar, but mainly Mark Antony, getting killed as Octavius wiped up the Ptolemies. When Egypt went down, Egypt became a subdivision of the Roman Empire. So they were given an extension of political life, but eventually they were overthrown. But now when the Roman Empire went down, there was no Rome as a part of any empire. That's true if you're looking at the Western Empire, which some say went down in 476, or the Eastern Roman Empire, which went down in 1453. In the West, the empire just crumbled. Nobody took it over, really. Rome just became a city. Actually, this extension of time could be a conflation of those two views. Paganism continued, but was finally wiped out after the Fourth Kingdom went down. Also, the political subdivisions remained for a while until the Fourth Kingdom was wiped out. Could be both. So let me read verse 12 again. As for the rest of the beasts, their authority to rule was removed, but an extension of life was granted to them for a certain period of time. So Babylon, Persia, and Alexander the Great and his successors had a little bit of life, but eventually they were kaputsky. So on that happy note, ladies and gentlemen, we have finished Daniel 7, verses 1 through 12. In our next audio, we will examine verses 13 through 28 to the end of the chapter, and we will call that audio The Ancient of Days and the Son of Man. I hope you stay tuned for this key passage of Scripture in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.